Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Book Spider podcast. We are a book of the week format podcast that strives to offer you the most discerning, the most thoughtful, the driest, and the least eager to please literary content in the podcasting sphere. I am Hans Berger. I'm one of the three hosts of Book Spider, along with my colleagues Patrick Barney and Chris Malmberg. And this morning we're going to be talking about Namwali Sirpel's novel, The Furrows. Now, this is a novel that just, it came out fairly recently. I think it's one of the most recent things that we've covered on the podcast. I believe it was just covered a couple months ago. When I went to pick it up from the library, it was still in the new fiction section. So for once, we're right on the cutting edge here, even by the rather broad definition of cutting edge offered by the world of literature. So a little bit of background first, and you know, this is always a spoiler-heavy podcast, right? We pretty much never feel like we can talk about a book at any length without going into plot details, but I would say certainly, you know, sometimes if you haven't read the book, enough time has passed that I don't feel bad spoiling it. Because this is a new book, I would say, first of all, if you haven't read it and you're listening to this episode, I would recommend it. I think it's a very interesting read. I assume the other two gentlemen would echo that. And I would say definitely go read it before you listen any further to this episode if you have any interest at all in reading this novel. You know, if you're if it's one of those situations where you've got to fake it for a book report, then, you know, you can proceed. But if you do have any interest in reading it, then go read it, and I'll see you back in a few days when you're done. So Namwali Sirpel's The Furrows is a fairly enigmatic novel, partly about grief, perhaps, partly about loss, perhaps, maybe about the shadows we carry in ourselves. It might also be a ghost story of sorts, though I couldn't necessarily swear to it. The narrator for the first half of the novel is Cassandra, usually just referred to as C. And in the opening scene of the novel, her brother dies when she's 12 and he's 7. They're swimming in the ocean. He nearly drowns. She swims out. She carries him back, but she passes out when they arrive at shore. And then the rising tide sweeps him back out or something. The details in that death scene are somewhat unclear, partly because she herself has passed out for much of it. And in the first half of the novel, there are two more alternate death scenes for Wayne, each of those death scenes becoming progressively stranger and more grotesque, even though they share certain details and certain keywords and phrases. So at the same time, there are also in the first half of the novel two scenes, presumably imagined, though it's never made totally clear, two scenes in which Cassandra, as a young adult, meets a stranger whom she suspects is Wayne, seconds before some sort of unnamed disaster occurs, right? So, you know, this is mostly a linear novel, I would say, in kind of its how the plot is laid out. Mostly a linear novel, but there are a couple of these odd sorts of, like, either imagined or alternate reality. Or the roots of these scenes are a little unclear, but While the main action of the novel is moving forward, one major kind of background thing to this action is that Cassandra's mother has started a nonprofit organization named Vigil, and that organization is dedicated to seeking missing children, particularly Wayne, who Cassandra's mother refuses to believe is actually dead. So there's a critical juncture near the middle of the novel where Cassandra and some man, share a flight together, which is an odd echo of how Cassandra's parents met. And upon landing, Cassandra and this mysterious man strike up a conversation shortly before a bomb, I think, hits the airport. So there's a really interesting effect here where in the first half of the novel, there's the death scene and then a couple alternate versions of the death scene. And then mixed in with the alternate versions of the death scene are a couple alternate versions of the meeting that has not occurred yet. And then at the end of the first half, there is the what seems to be the actual meeting between Cassandra and this person whose name does in fact turn out to be Wayne Williams, right? Wayne Williams, of course, being the name of her lost, presumed dead brother. So Cassandra and Wayne go to the hospital to treat their injuries from the bombing, then go to a hotel, then have sex. Immediately following the sex, the POV shifts so that Wayne Williams becomes our narrator, right? And it takes some time to gather and assemble all the details, but basically the story that comes out is that Wayne met another child when he was at school who looked like him, had his name, and eventually this other child, this kind of doppelganger version of himself, appeared in a video assaulting another boy, and Wayne, who looked identical to him, was blamed for this assault, was sent to juvenile hall, later got another sentence that kept him in prison as an adult due to something else this doppelganger did. And he saw a poster for Vigil, learned more about this other doppelganger Wayne, discovered that Cassandra's brother, Wayne, went missing in Baltimore, which is where he grew up, and somehow got the theory that perhaps this, when this brother had gone missing, instead of dying, he had ended up in the Baltimore public school system as a foster child and become the doppelganger who had ruined his life. So there's a misunderstanding that causes Wayne to be assaulted by the police. Wayne and Cassandra fall in love briefly, and then an earthquake hits San Francisco. A giant monstrous black cloud rises out of the bay, and that is the moment at which the novel ends. So reading this plot summary, reading this plot synopsis, I'm really taken aback. You know, at the time that I was reading it, I was working hard enough to just keep up with the damn thing and make sure that I had the details and the events documented well enough to be able to give a decent synopsis for this podcast, right? And to try to write up a few kind of discussion questions about it. Reading through that synopsis now, I'm really taken aback by, on the one hand, the kind of creativity of some of the structure of it, right? The way that the real scenes and the imagined scenes echo each other in a way, as structurally, and the how the first half opens with one traumatic scene and then has kind of the alternate versions mixed in with alternate versions of another traumatic scene that closes that second half. There's something almost symphonic about the structural symmetry of that, right? And then the POV shift in the second half, the whole, you know, in the second half, the kind of doppelganger plotline, you know, we talk a lot on this podcast about, I feel like I somewhat regularly connect these novels to David Lynch films for some reason, and the kind of doppelganger plotline in the second half feels very Lynchian to me in kind of the best sense of that word, right? You know, the way that he kind of creates these emotional, the way he creates these surreal things, that these surreal sequences that don't have any like easy rational explanation, but which kind of have an emotional truth to them. It's all very impressive. And at the same time, the style has, it's very impressively written at a stylistic level. There's a lot of, just interesting turns of phrase. There's enough of a social justice angle to it at the same time, which I think we'll get into a bit more, that it feels very contemporary at the same time and has a very distinct voice to it. So I think I finished the novel thinking, huh, that was a lot and I'm not sure how I feel about it. describing it now, I'm very impressed with the memory that I'm having of it. So I don't always ask this. We don't always ask this, but I am just kind of curious to start with how you guys kind of responded to this subjectively and what your I assume neither of you had read it or knew much about it, but coming to it the first time, how did you feel about it?
Yeah, I liked it a lot. I partway through, I think it was the successive echoes of Wayne One's death and disappearance that kind of weighed heavily on like the subjective in the moment experience of reading the novel, where kind of reliving trauma again and again is maybe not like how I want to spend my time generally reading, but then it kind of accrues a thematic weight to it, and the style is, as you said, the sentence level style is strong, and there's enough humor and playfulness to kind of counterbalance, you know, the really melancholy subject matter. And I had not put it together until you said it, Hans, that basically the second sort of echoed event, she's meeting Wayne in three different ways. Like, and I actually thought it was, I didn't really place that when I was reading it, that this is actually, this is actually something that is echoed from the future. And the third time that they meet is, you know, may or may not be the real time. You know, one of the lines in the novel is, I don't want to tell you what happened, I want to tell you what it felt like, or something like that. And that,
I think that's the first line in the novel.
Yeah, it? and it's said several times throughout the novel, and that kind of feels like maybe these different sort of, like, did Wayne actually disappear out at sea, or is that just another sort of like attempt at sort of encompassing the emotions of that, you know, the experience of that loss in a kind of a metaphorical way. And I don't know that it necessarily has to be, that first one has to be true, or Wayne and C meeting on a plane right before the bomb drops versus the first time they meet, I think, is in like a coffee shop or something like that. And then something terrible happens too outside, and he has to rescue her there as well. But it's interesting too that he rescues her, and in that second echoed experience, and she's trying to rescue her brother Wayne in the first echoed experience. But all that to say, it's very like satisfying to think about this novel. It was very satisfying to read it. And I don't know in the end what to make of it altogether, which, you, as you know, is like my true catnip. I love being confused. So I'm curious, Patrick, what did you think?
I think I have an overall positive reaction to the novel. Structurally, I definitely find it interesting, like the switching between the three different narrators, so I thought that was successful. And like, I definitely am interested in like this idea of imposters, like between Wayne Williams and his doppelganger who goes by the name Will. That's that seem to really encapsulate the question of what's real and what's not in a really interesting way to me. Like the dynamic between Wayne and Will and, you know, are either of them C's brother? Probably neither of them are C's brother, but you know, that I found that interesting. I do have a couple of gripes though. One, I'm gonna dissent from both of you and say that on the sentence level I found it actually rather clunky. So for example, I believe when we first see Wayne's death, I believe the simile that Serpell uses compares the body to being as still as a magician's assistant. That is an awful simile. As far as like how does that make any sense? Like when you go to see a magic show, the assistant moves around all the time. Like I'm not sure what that does. But I don't think that that's just a one-off though. I think her usage of similes throughout is pretty bad actually. So another example was comparing a smile to an accordion being stretched out, which isn't like bad in and of itself, except that it's like this kind of horrifying or really kind of puts you on edge type of simile, which I didn't think was effective for the overall kind of surreal or strange atmosphere. There was another one about a tattoo of a flock of birds looking like shrapnel. I don't see, like, that seemed bad to me too. So there were the sentence level stuff didn't strike me as super good, and then the in the beginning, the two, like, so we originally see Wayne drowning in the ocean, Cassandra's trying to save him, and that's like the way that we originally think he dies. And then there are two alternate scenes, like you pointed out in the intro, Hans. But the usage of similar phrases really turned me off. And the reason it turned me off was just because it just made it boring. It made it feel repetitious rather than interesting. And it reminded me, there's actually a scene in a fantasy novel by Robert Jordan, the guy who wrote the Wheel of Time series. And I think it's in the second book where a main character steps into a room and like the scene plays out for a second, for a few minutes. And then in the book, to signify that the scene is like returning to a beginning point and then going to play out again, the author uses the exact same words that he has for the last two pages. So, you might think that's a fun effect, but it really just sucks. Like, cause you really just are rereading the same thing. And I like, it wasn't as bad in Serpell's book, but it had a similar effect on me. Like I didn't think that that was super interesting. It made me think, I'm reading the same thing over again. So despite those gripes and criticisms, like overall, I had a positive experience and think that this is an interesting novel, and I want to know more. Like, I want to work it out. But, you know, anyway, what were you saying,
Holly? Yeah, I mean, as far as the particular issue of the recurring words and phrases in the different death scenes, I think that my thought on reading that initially was, there's that key phrase that Chris has pointed to, right? I don't want to tell you what happened. I wanted to tell you how it felt. And my assumption was that the things that repeated were things that were chosen to evoke emotion, right? And so the details of the event are less important than the kind of the phrases that suggest the emotive quality of being there. Now, you could argue perhaps that there's two ways to receive that, I think, right? I suppose if you want to look at it positively, then the details of the event change, but the words which evoke the emotional texture of the event stay consistent, because the emphasis is on, again, telling you what it felt like, right? I mean, that's I think that seems to me like a rationale for that technique, right? Now, you could argue, I think, that if the words which evoked feeling were different from one description to another, then the three versions might actually have a stronger cumulative effect at collectively evoking the feeling of the thing, right? And I did not have any objection to the technique as I was reading it, so I couldn't really, you know, take the second position, but I can understand why it might feel like a wasted opportunity, perhaps. And the similes, I wasn't bothered. I think, like, the still as a magician's assistant, I do actually remember puzzling over that for a second. I guess I think of the magician's assistant as being the magician's assistant is often in a passive role, right? So if you think about the trick of, you know, you're put in a box and the box is cut in half, right? The magician's assistant, the magician is the one who's moving around, doing the patter, using the saw. The magician's assistant passively stands there and has the illusion of violence inflicted upon often her, right? So the magician's assistant is in a passive role and has violence inflicted upon her, or trickery inflicted upon her. And that was how I understood that simile. Now, it might be that, I mean, I think that that's probably a simile that functions more, you know, like, in theory, a descriptive simile should help give you a sensory impression of the events, right? And I do think it's a fair criticism that the magician's assistant simile probably isn't something that's helpful for you in visualizing the child's body, right? It's a little too dense, and it's something that's more kind of like effective in an abstract way, if it is effective. It was effective to me in an abstract way, but I would cede the criticism that it is maybe not descriptively effective at a more sensual, at a more sensory level, right? So, I mean, I think both those critiques, I actually totally understand where you're coming from and why, you know, you might have had that response, but they're not things that bothered me at the time that I was reading. I do, though. I mean, the first question that I had does get into some things that I don't know if I'd call them criticisms, but some things that you could point to as some things that might disappoint certain readers of the novel, right? So the first thing that I was wondering was, a lot of what I had read about this novel ahead of time, and I think even some of what's on the inner jacket flap, suggests that it's a novel about grief, right? And my question is it a novel about grief? If yes, does it succeed at being a novel about grief, right? Like, how does it play with the themes of grief, and does it do those successfully or not?
This is a line that I go to thinking about this question, Hans, from one of C's therapists, and she describes something called ambiguous loss. And I didn't look this up before the podcast. I was wondering if that was a real term, but how the therapist describes it seems a little bit like a key for, or a lens for looking at these doppelganger issues, the insistence, C's mother's insistence that Wayne is still alive, and also C's own, even though rationally she tells herself that Wayne is dead, even though she insists to her mother that Wayne is dead, C still has it in herself to kind of suffer the same desire to see Wayne around her or to seek him. And the ambiguous loss that her therapist describes is a loss where the death is unconfirmed or unconfirmable, such that, you know, a person might still be out there, though it's very unlikely. Everyone just believes that this person is dead. And that sort of precipitating a kind of pattern-seeking behavior in the brain, you know, looking for that person. And I thought that that was maybe a piece of what we're experiencing in these sort of ripples. But then I think there's also, you know, it seems like quantum has come up several times over the past, you know, year on this podcast. And it does seem as though there is an intent for us to read this as a kind of a trauma in time and ripples in time that are stretching forward and backward, or I don't know if forward and backward makes sense in time, but basically, you know, we have a friend of Wayne. I'm going to call him Wayne 2, because there's actually three Waynes. Wayne 2, I'm going to say, is the narrator. The second narrator that they're all narrator. Wayne 2 is the one that C sleeps with, and then we have Wayne 3, who we might not talk about him, but Wayne 2,
he's the doppelganger. Are you thinking of Wayne 3 as kind of the doppelganger who curses Wayne 2 in the school system?
No, there's a third Wayne. So the school system, he's the school system Wayne. You're right. He's the doppelganger that Wayne 2 meets in school. And then Wayne 3, since you brought it up, actually doesn't believe, Wayne 3 believes that another person who looks like him committed the curb stomp that got both Wayne 2 and Wayne 3 in trouble. But that's kind of maybe a separate conversation. But all of this, it feels like it. If you're going to sort of like anchor this to grief, you would anchor it in the people who had experienced the loss. But this doppelganger sort of like reverberation, like the kind of need to believe that Wayne is still alive, the sort of like inability for the rational parts of your brain to insist that, no, that's not Wayne. That's not possible. And to be carried along by, you know, the endocrine system, the feelings in your body, the conviction that this might be your brother. If it was anchored in the people who had lost Wayne, that would feel more like it was focused in on the grief. This feels like it's interested in that, but also in confusing that. Wayne 2's mentor, I think his name is Mo, talks about time and furrows, and, you know, he has the line in the book about, and you have it here, time's got grooves in it, a moment is a needle, and time can skip like a record, And it feels like there's something going on there as well. And is that also complicated by a ghost story element? All this to say, I don't know that it really gets at grief in a way that is focused enough to be profound. It's very interesting, but it feels like that's just a piece of something larger.
Yeah, there are certain ways, I think, in which the surrealism of the book, for lack of a better term, right? And by the surrealism of it, I mean, well, should be pretty clear what I mean, I guess, from the synopsis I gave. But there are ways in which I think the surrealism of the book and also some of the social satire elements of the book are sometimes an impediment to real depth of characterization. And I think there might be a lot of how we experience C's grief is mediated through the sorts of, a lot of how we experience C's grief is mediated through just the strangeness of the events, right? And if to your point, a lot of the time skipping effect and the alternate versions of reality, if part of that is meant to conjure up that effect of kind of the strength of grief being something which makes time skip like a record in a groove, or makes time skip like a needle in the groove of a record, that's conceptually very interesting, but it doesn't necessarily, the way that it's presented here, I don't know that it, and I don't have a great deal of expertise in grief as a griever or a psychologist or anything, but it didn't necessarily convey something of the level of emotional kind of grandeur that I would expect to be associated with an event like the one the novel's about, right? It's fascinating, it's interesting, but it's not, I mean, if you think about literature as kind of being an exercise in empathy and perspective taking, I don't know that I would have left this with any empathetic sense of what it would be like to be someone in C's position, right? Because so much of it is manifested through these kinds of surreal events. And I think the mother character, right, who would be the person maybe most profoundly affected by this grief, is really kind of a cartoon, right? Like there's a lack of dimensionality to her. There's a way in which she seems to mostly function. It's like she's kind of there mostly to function as a satire of a particular type of middle-class white lady. And the fact that she's kind of so consistently the butt of that satirical joke really undermines the idea that we're somehow exploring her grief, you know? Now, I like the novel a lot if it's not taken as a really kind of deep meditation on grief, right? I still enjoyed it in spite of that, but if I had come to it expecting that, I would have maybe been let down.
Well, I'm probably just going to say stuff that you guys have already said, but it seems like it's, to be about grief, the novel would need to be more interested in transparency and less interested in like this wacky stuff that it's also interested in, you know, with these alternate death scenes and alternate meetings and between Cassandra and Lane, and then, you know, the doppelganger wanes. Like, there's all this weird stuff going on that, you know, just doesn't really help us out. If we're trying to think about grief and meditate on grief, all this other stuff doesn't really funnel towards a meditation on grief. It funnels in other ways. So yeah, I think I'm agreeing with both of you. It doesn't, like, maybe partially it's about grief, but it doesn't succeed at being about grief, I would say.
Right, right. It seems like the plot element of grief is kind of more there as a, It's more there as a mechanism to kind of be used to further these other elements of, on the one hand, this kind of surreal, very effective, I think, surrealist narrative and the kind of doppelganger imagery, the doubling imagery. It's more used to kind of set a stage for that, and more used, I think, as a mechanism to some of the kind of social and class and race satire that I hope we'll talk about a little bit later on. So the next question that I had is, I think we've pretty much organically worked through, but it might be worth just kind of trying to take it as an opportunity to sort of double back and sum up some of what we've talked about. So I'd asked what the meaning or the purpose was of the alternate death scenes and the alternate meeting scenes, and whether there was, in fact, a true one, right? And I think to the question of whether there's a true death scene and a true meeting scene, you had both suggested that perhaps there's not, right? Perhaps we're biased toward a particular one just because it's the first one that we encounter in the narrative, but that if the stated purpose is, again, as you said, Chris, to say what it felt like, not what happened, then there's not necessarily any reason to think that there is a particular death scene that we can definitively point to as the real one. I suppose as far as the meeting scene, maybe we can point a little more definitively to that as a real one, because there are events that happen afterward which, you know, are in reference to it, right? But even that, I think there's this weird echo where C's parents met on an airplane flight and C and Wayne meet on an airplane flight. And that coincidence seems, I don't know if I can say exactly what the coincidence does, but among other things, it seems to me like it casts a little bit of doubt on the absolute reality of that version of the meeting, right? Because there's something about the way that it's echoing family history that seems to put this kind of veil of subjectivity over it, possibly. And you, Chris, had pointed to the quote that I pulled out, right? Time's got grooves in it. A moment is a needle and time can skip like a record. Time is like the ground, and when something big happens, it's an earthquake, and when it's little, it's ripples, like those rows on a farm. And of course, C names those ripples furrows later on, and it's notable that in the ocean death scene at the beginning, there's a reference to furrows in the water, right? So if Wayne is being pulled out into the water, in some sense, he's being pulled into those kind of furrows of ripples in time. I think that your comparison to quantum theory, even though the term quantum is never used here, and I don't think this is written in any kind of, I don't think this is written with any particular fealty to quantum science. Your comparison, Chris, to quantum theory seems like an apt one, right? Just to the extent that I think one consequence of the cultural absorption of quantum theory has been that we all have this kind of cultural idea of the universe as having these alternate versions of things that ripple out from these kind of moments of decision and possibility.
It's not just cultural, like there is an actual theory of quantum mechanics.
Right. But that theory, I think, has been absorbed into the culture in a particular way that this novel bears out, even if, I don't know if Serpell has any particular familiarity with quantum theory or if she studied, I don't see any reason to think that this is based on a careful reading of, you know, quantum theory. Maybe it is, maybe I'm underrating it, I don't know, but.
Let me jump in here, since you just said you don't think that this is based on any like real investigation of quantum theory. And I probably agree, but I do wonder if saying that this book is science fiction does anything for us. So let me explain. So when I looked up this novel to get it on Amazon or get it on Audible so I could listen to it, I noticed that Sir Pell also wrote her first novel, called The Old Drift. And reading synopses of that, it was called a science fiction novel, and I forget the details, but you know, clearly this novel has some things that could be interpreted in a science fiction type way, specifically this idea of like alternate deaths and alternate meetings between Wayne and C, corresponding to multiple worlds theory of quantum mechanics, where every possible outcome happens in some state, in a superposition of states, right? So if we're reading this as a sci-fi novel that is interested in that idea, does that make the purpose or meaning of the alternate death scenes clearer? Does it make it more interesting, less interesting? You know, not that I actually know what it means to call something sci-fi and something literary. Like we've kind of touched on this stuff before, and like even before the podcast, we had a YouTube discussion on it. And I'm like, what has come to me from all these discussions is that I have no idea, like, if there's a real difference between literary and non-literary fiction. I really don't. But I'm just wondering, if we say this is science fiction, does that help us in any way?
I wonder if it draws more attention to the end. So the end, there's a kind of a theme of apocalyptic thought that runs through the novel.
Right.
And it kind of is sort of like well, first of all, there's all these sort of disasters that are sort of happening around C. But also this kind of fixation on Wayne's death seems to be kind of refracted forward in a sort of a bit of a kind of a recurring rumination on the end. And at the end of the novel, we do see a kind of apocalypse, a very strange, hard to kind of really pull out exactly what's occurring, but it does seem like some giant cataclysm is hitting at least where they are in that moment. And I don't know if that is, if then that, you know, you say sci-fi, you know, like sci-fi, you might, if you're writing a sci-fi novel, you might, you know, sort of maybe begin by asking a question of how does like a collective traumatic event intersect with personal traumatic events in time or something like that. And then you could, you know, maybe explore something like that. And if you were angling a little more literary, maybe you wouldn't, you know, maybe you wouldn't. I think that the distinction is not very useful in terms of like defining essential qualities of literary versus genre fiction. But I think maybe the tools that, you know, the writer starts out with might be a little bit different.
So the idea of quantum theory, right, would be that there's a moment and subsequent to that moment, there's a branching into two different versions that each moves forward in parallel, right? And that seems to me like it would, it's what you're seeing with the alternate death scenes is not a branching where things move forward in parallel. It's somehow the same thing in a way, recurring in different ways in different worlds. So, I mean, normally I think if you were to do a parallel universe version of this, the default would be there's one where Wayne lives and one where he dies, right? Sure. And instead of one where he lives and one where he dies, we have these, it's almost more, if you think of these as happening in parallel universes, which the more that I talk, the less I'm sold on, right? But if you think of these as happening in parallel universes, it, what you end up with is a bizarre kind of grotesque inevitability, right? Almost like some kind of malign force beyond the understanding of these characters, or malign or not, some force beyond the understanding of these characters is like always dragging the universe into this particular shape, right? It's less a matter of alternate versions branching out from one moment and more some kind of dreadful gravity that always pulls the moment into this echo of the same thing.
Now, I mean, that's like the cliche of how it would play out in many science fiction novels, I guess. But there's no reason why it would have to be that way, since, like, well, I don't know. I feel like that's just being nitpicky. So,
well, they're infinite, right? I mean, the quantum universes are infinite. So certainly, from a quantum perspective, it's possible that all these exist.
Right.
So, I mean, I think you're right that it's not, like, you're right that it's not a quantum reading is not mutually exclusive to the multiple parallels.
Right. Yeah. That's all I was, like, driving at, and but thinking about it, it feels nitpicky.
I take your point, right? I mean, I think that, like, I think it was worth approaching a sci-fi reading of this. I'm not sure that I can pull anything out of it, really, right? I mean, if we think of a sci-fi reading as one in which quote-unquote scientific principles are brought to bear to help kind of explain what might otherwise seem like
surrealism,
magic or surrealism.
Yeah. Well, let me jump in, because I actually think, Patrick, your question sort of unlocks for me maybe an avenue for getting at that ending, which, Hans, if you don't mind me stepping on it, kind of asking this question of you guys and thinking about it myself. If we take out the science fiction elements and kind of our desire to sort of like look for them, what do we do with the ending? What's happening at the end of this book? And it reminds me of Mona a little bit. Mona also.
I was going to make that comparison. Yeah. Mona by Paula Olawiharik, a book we've talked about previously on this podcast. Yeah.
What happens there? So like Ragnarok happens at the end or something.
Yeah. Yeah, right, Ragnarok right. happens.
Fucking and that, Ragnarok, man.
That's a novella in which the protagonist experiences a very really terrible traumatic sexual assault and goes to a kind of writer's retreat, and then Ragnarok at the very end, Ragnarok happens, and it's yeah. it's very complicated, but it is interesting in that that novella and this novel both have personal traumatic experiences preceded by these massive apocalypses. And I think, like, if we take out the desire to sort of like look for, you know, patterns that might unlock some sort of like, you know, tech science conceptual like frame, like, what is there a kind of a literary, is there a kind of a, what do we do with the ending, I guess? And maybe maybe it's interesting to look at that ending as not not a kind of sci-fi thing. I don't know. I thought it was a more clever question when I thought of it.
Well, it's certainly possible, like, an earthquake can lead to a tsunami, right? Like, that's perfectly realistic and at least conceptually in line with what happens at the end. So, like, I don't know what it would mean and why, like, you would end the novel with a real disaster in this way. But
yeah, I was hoping one of you guys would say something to make me like the ending more, because I was not particularly taken with it.
I gotta break it. I fucking love the ending of Mona, and I'm with you. I don't know if I like the ending of The Furrows, and I think that that's kind of interesting. But sorry, go on.
Well, I love the ending of Mona because it feels earned in a way, and it feels significant in a way, right? As I remember, our interpretation of the ending of Mona, or at least my interpretation of the ending of Mona, was that, you know, you have this, and I feel bad for any listeners who haven't read Mona, but I certainly would recommend it because it's a great book. In Mona, you have this community full of people who are writers, and ostensibly the idea of being a writer is to make meaning, among other things, among many other things. Like, you know, one of the things you should be doing as a writer is making meaning in ways that help people organize the world, in ways which help them kind of process loss and trauma and sorrow and et cetera, right? And these writers are all completely ignoring the real duties of literature and, you know, schmoozing and sleeping together and professionalizing. And so, you know, you have this protagonist who is in fact having the kind of traumatic event that the arts and literature from a pragmatic standpoint should perhaps be helpful in processing. And there's a certain justice in seeing all that swept away, because it is dross, it is bullshit, right? They've turned it into dross and bullshit. And I think with The Furrows, it was very hard for me to not, I mean, there's so much about trauma in this novel too, right? But like, it reminded the monster, you know, the two characters, in spite of everything, reach a point of happiness, and then as soon as they reach the point of happiness, something envelops them from outside. And it was hard for me not to read that as personal trauma, social trauma, racism, you know, capitalism, right? All the kind of they think they've found happiness, but all the bullshit of the world is going to rise up and destroy it, right? I mean, there may be other readings for it, but like, it was hard for me not to get that reading of it. And it just, you know, my wife and I went and watched the Alex Garland film Men a few months ago, right? Whenever it was in the theater, we went and saw it, and I really enjoyed it. But as I was walking out, we had a conversation about it. We were both like, is it played out to have a horror movie where the monster is a metaphor for trauma, right? Is that now kind of a thing that has reached a level of predictability? And that tsunami felt like, or that, you know, black thing rising out of the bay that is maybe a tsunami, but maybe, and who knows. There are hints of that elsewhere, right? Like, there are a couple references in the novel to like a black shape, visions of a rising black shape. I think Wayne 2, as you've dubbed him, Chris, I think Wayne 2 has some visions of a rising black shape. But it just kind of felt like a horror movie where the monster is a metaphor for trauma, right? And you can kind of get away with bending the rules a little bit within the rules of the horror movie, because the monster is actually a metaphor for trauma, and that thematic idea kind of lends the illusion of importance to something. And it just felt like a lesser version of the ending from Mona. And I don't know, I just, it seemed like almost like a parody of, you know, like if you imagine like the way that the children tell stories, right? Then, you know, it's like Animal blowing up the stage at the end of a Muppet Show episode, because they can't think of any other way to end it. I don't know. It seemed thematically one-dimensional and dramatically unsatisfying to me. And maybe there's some big thing it's doing I'm totally blind to. I am completely open to that possibility. I wish I knew what it was. But so we haven't talked a whole lot about race and class and kind of social satire, which are pretty significant aspects of the novel, right? The narrator's mixed race. Her father's black, her mother's white. There are several key dramatic moments that are inflected with concerns about race. Most notably, the scene near the end where Wayne is assaulted in the airport by police. Do you guys have any thoughts about how the aspects of race and class fit into the aspects of surrealism and trauma and grief, and any thoughts about how those kind of integrate into a larger piece?
I don't know. I mean, other than, I don't know how to assemble anything. It's sort of, it's, you know, kind of what, coming off of what you were, the criticisms that you were levying at, Men, the movie. I don't know whether to throw the same or similar criticisms at this book for covering ground that I think seems pretty familiar in terms of like police brutality, and, you know, domestic tension between the white in-laws and the black in-laws, and that resentment trickling down to the kids in the family who belong in to neither population, to neither demographic. I think it was all well done. And I guess I don't want to levy any criticism. I just don't know if I'm looking for it to amount to something more. I don't know what that would be, other than, you know, some well-told scenes where this, you know, the experience of being a black person in America is allowed to play out. I don't know. I don't know what to do with it thematically. If it is sort of a piece that is meant to kind of feed into a larger sort of understanding of, like, you know, the tsunami that engulfs them in the end, then I do kind of feel like I would have wanted more, like, just like more information, more complexity in it. And I'm saying that as a white guy. So I welcome and deserve any criticisms for my lack of appreciation of it. But it feels like it feels like we've been hearing these stories for a while now, and I don't know that I learned anything unexpected from those pieces that were tackling race, if that makes sense.
Well, and it may be that the, and this is ultimately a criticism of myself for asking the question, I suppose, but it might be that the, it's maybe a fallacy of criticism that there has to be a unified theory for every text, right? That, you know, maybe this does some surrealism stuff. It does a little bit of grief stuff. It does some class, race, satire, trauma stuff. And those don't, there doesn't have to be an equation that can turn those into one unified statement. It just does those three things, and that's that, right?
I'm particularly fine. I think, like you said, you said Lynchian at one point, and another point you mentioned a dark force that is just, you know, in every version of the story, even if it's just versions of the story that get at what it felt like to lose Wayne. The dark force is dragging Wayne away into a dark place that into which there is no access or perspective. Like Wayne disappears, and a dark force that is like there present, dooming them all. I think Bernard C's father says, you know, death is all around us. I like that reading. I'm fond of that. I don't know if that needs to actually it doesn't necessarily need to be built of that doesn't need to necessarily need to be able to be cooked down into anything more discreet for me. That's how I choose to like this novel.
I mean, the ultimately, you know, these are particular characters and they live in a specific world and there are particularities of their world. And there's the question of race and the way that it's encountered as a plot device is just a manifestation of the particularities of their world that will inevitably be there. And that's that, right? I suppose you could, I don't know, I think this is one of those texts where, many of the explanatory keys that you can propose almost immediately begin to feel reductive, right? Like, if you try to make a metaphorical argument that doppelganger Wayne is, that evil doppelganger Wayne is symbolic somehow of, I don't know, like, the self-loathing that comes from growing up poor in a racist society, right? You could maybe make a case for that, I suppose, but it immediately begins to kind of dissipate some of the just eerie, the kind of pleasurable eeriness of the doppelganger imagery, right? It's, for me, I think a lot of it is more enjoyable if you don't try to push it into an allegoric or metaphoric box. Even though, you know, I'm sitting here trying to come up with discussion questions that will encourage us to do that.
Well, I kind of think maybe it's just a fault of criticism, but that's the only thing criticism can do ultimately, right? Is to apply meanings to a text because otherwise it doesn't have anything to do. So with
something like this, or with something like this, or the Golem, right? There's a very narrow middle path where you can have enough understanding to stay with the text, but not so much understanding that you can have enough understanding to stay with the text, but enough mystery to create a kind of sense of ominousness and dread. And if you stray too far in one direction or the other, that calibration goes off and it diminishes the experience, right? With like this or the Golem or some of the Aickman stories that we've talked about recently. And the work of analysis almost inevitably, because so much of what makes something like this effective is this very subjective response to the slightly inexplicable, so much of the work of analysis ends up kind of being something that if it succeeds in mastering the text, it will pull it off that central path and ruin some of its effect, right? So maybe these are all things that I've picked, and maybe I should just stop.
Well, I mean, you know, like you say, analysis, just because of what it is going to treat it's going to have different results for different books, you know, like a reading of it, of Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, that comes to the conclusion that, like, the meatpacking industry at the time was pretty effing horrible, you know, that's fine. Like, that's what the novel is getting at. Here, since this novel may not be getting at anything, really, like, the task of analysis, insofar as it is to apply meaning, is necessarily not going to serve us well, right?
Analysis is rooted in the assumption that things must be explicable, and some amount of inexplicability is necessary for the subjective effect of a text like this one. Well, if that's not an epitaph for a podcast, then I don't know what is. All right. Any other thoughts that you guys wanted to throw out about this book before we move on?
I'm eager to see what else she writes. It's distinctive. I mean, like, I enjoyed it. In talking about it, I feel like there are things about it that I found, were a little bit lacking, and things that I, you know, was, moved by, and enjoyed, but I think really, really it's distinctive. And so, I'm really interested to see what she writes next. Cause it can be pretty boring out there with all the books. I wasn't bored by this one.
Yeah. I guess it's funny because most of what we've, like, I opened the podcast with this statement of great admiration, and then almost everything we've said has been to one extent or another critical, I suppose, mostly of the ways in which it doesn't quite achieve the, most standard thematic or aesthetic effects that one assumes from a novel that is about the things that it's about. But the kind of ragged quality it has that it uses to kind of dodge some of those thematic questions is what I found quite intriguing in the time of reading it. And even though I've said a lot of things that could be construed as negative about it, I still had a terrific time reading it. And I can imagine coming back to it in a couple years when I've had enough time to forget most of the details and really enjoying another run through of it. All right. So am I remembering right that I think we had done a little bit of rearranging of the schedule to allow for doing two Cormac McCarthy's. Is that next, or do we have to wait a little bit longer for the publication of the other McCarthy novel?
Stella Maris will be coming out Tuesday of next week. So
9 days from now.
Yeah. So we have, there's a couple of things though, because I won't be able to do, the weekend, like the 11th anyway. If we were to push our next recording day back to the 18th, would that give everyone enough to, would people be able to do that? And would people be able to do The Passenger first, followed by Stella Maris if Maris came out on the 6th?
I've already read The Passenger, so I have plenty of time whatever Sunday we meet.
Yeah, I think Stella Maris is pretty short.
Yeah. It's shorter than, like, I think Passenger is like 400 pages or a little less, and Stella Maris is
383.
Okay, 383, and Stella Maris is probably only in the 200s or
yeah, it's
less.
190.
208.
190. Okay, yeah. So.
Yeah, I mean, I can read what I've got to read when I've got to read it by.
You know? Oh my God! Listen to him.
Give me the assignment and I'll fucking do it, you know?
Yeah. I remember that about
the quality
you.
Of analysis they vary,
yeah, they called you the bookworm. Hans Bookworm Burger. So our next books are The Passenger and Stella Maris by Cormac McCarthy. So even though we had set a new recency record with The Furrows, we're actually going to be reading a book that is just hot off the presses in Stella Maris. It's not even coming out until the 6th, but they are a pair that go together by Cormac McCarthy. And I chose them just kind of after reading a review that talked about what else the subject of, quantum mathematics and the intersection of science and humanity as being subjects in these novels. And it had been a while since I'd read a McCarthy, so those two things sort of factored into me choosing these.
All right. Well, we will be talking at some point in the next few weeks about The Passenger and Stella Maris by Cormac McCarthy. And this has been the Book Spider Podcast. Thank you much, everybody, for your time and attention, as always. If you have any thoughts, any criticisms, any disagreements, feel free to reach out to us at, what's the email address, Patrick?
BookSpider1001@gmail.com.
Excellent.
1001.
All right. I'll talk to you guys later.
Peace.
All right. Peace, guys.